Chapter 3
"If he threw her over, I wouldn't think she would want to tell anybody about it," Quentin said.
"Ah," Mr. Compson said again.
"After Mr. Coldfield died in 64, Miss Rosa moved out to Sutphen's Hundred to live with Judith. She was 20 then, 4 years younger than the niece whom, in obedience to her sister's dying request, she set out to save from the family's doom, which Sutphen seemed bent on accomplishing, apparently by the process of marrying him. She, Miss Rosa, was born in 1845, with her sister already 7 years married and the mother of two children, and Miss Rosa born into her parents' middle age. Her mother must have been at least 40, and she died in that childbed, and Miss Rosa never forgave her father for it. And at a time when, granted that Miss Rosa merely mirrored her parents' attitude toward the son-in-law, the family wanted only peace and quiet, and probably did not expect and maybe did not even want another child. But she was born, at the price of her mother's life, and never to be permitted to forget it, and raised by the same spinster aunt who tried to force not only the elder sister's bridegroom but the wedding too down the throat of a town which did not want it. Growing up in that closed masonry of females, to see in the fact of her own breathing not only the lone justification for the sacrifice of her mother's life, not only a living and walking reproach to her father, but a breathing indictment, ubiquitous and even transferable, of the entire male principle, that principle which had left the aunt a virgin at 35, above dust. So for the first 16 years of her life she lived in that grim, tight little house with the father whom she hated without knowing it, that queer, silent man whose only companion and friend seems to have been his conscience, and the only thing he cared about his reputation for probity among his fellow men. That man who was later to nail himself in his attic and starve to death, rather than look upon his native land in the throes of repelling an invading army. And the aunt who even 10 years later was still taking revenge for the fiasco of Ellen's wedding by striking at the town, the human race, through any and all of its creatures, brother, nieces, nephew-in-law, herself and all, with the blind irrational fury of a shedding snake, who had taught Miss Rosa to look upon her sister as a woman who had vanished, not only out of the family and the house, but out of life too, into an edifice like Bluebeard's, and there transmogrified into a mask, looking back with passive and hopeless grief upon the irrevocable world, held there not in durance but in a kind of jeering suspension by a man, his face the same which Mr. Coldfield now saw and had seen since that day when, with his future son-in-law for ostensible yoke-mate but actually whip, Mr. Coldfield's conscience had set the brakes and, surrendering even his share of the cargo, he and the son-in-law had parted, who had entered hers and her family's life before she was born with the abruptness of a tornado, done irrevocable and incalculable damage, and gone on. A grim mausoleum air of Puritan righteousness and outraged female vindictiveness, in which Miss Rosa's childhood, that aged and ancient and timeless absence of youth which consisted of a Cassandra-like listening beyond closed doors, of lurking in dim halls filled with that Presbyterian effluvium of lugubrious and vindictive anticipation, while she waited for the infancy and childhood with which nature had confounded and betrayed her to overtake the precocity of convinced disapprobation regarding any and everything which could penetrate the walls of that house through the agency of any man, particularly her father, which the aunt seems to have invested her with at birth along with the swaddling clothes, was past. Perhaps she saw in her father's death, in the resultant necessity upon her as not only an orphan but a pauper, to turn to her next of kin for food and shelter and protection, and this kin the niece whom she had been asked to save. Perhaps she saw in this fate itself supplying her with the opportunity to observe her sister's dying request. Perhaps she even saw herself as an instrument of retribution, if not in herself an active instrument strong enough to cope with him, at least as a kind of passive symbol of inescapable remindin' to rise bloodless and without dimension from the sacrificial stone of the marriage bed. Because until he came back from Virginia in 66 and found her living there with Judith and Clytie, Yes, Clytie was his daughter, too, Clytemnestra. He named her himself. He named them all himself. All his own get and all the get of his wild niggers after the country began to assimilate them. Miss Rosa didn't tell you that two of the niggers in the wagon that day were women?
No, sir, Quentin said.
Yes, two of them. And brought here neither by chance nor oversight. He saw to that, who had doubtless seen even further ahead than the 2 years it actually took him to build his house and show his good intentions to his neighbors, until they allowed him to mix his wild stock with their tame, since the difference in tongue between his niggers and theirs could have been a barrier only for a matter of weeks, or perhaps even days. He brought the two women deliberately. He probably chose them with the same care and shrewdness with which he chose the other livestock, the horses and mules and cattle, which he bought later on. And he lived out there for almost 5 years before he had speaking acquaintance with any white woman in the county, just as he had no furniture in his house, and for the same reason. He had at the time nothing to exchange for it, them or her. Yes, he named Clytie as he named them all, the one before Clytie and Henry and Judith even, with that same robust and sardonic temerity, naming with his own mouth his own ironic fecundity of dragon's teeth, which, with the two exceptions, were girls. Only I have always liked to believe that he intended to name her Cassandra, prompted by some pure dramatic economy not only to beget but to designate the presiding augur of his own disaster, and that he just got the name wrong through a mistake natural in a man who must have almost taught himself to read. When he returned home in 66, she had not seen him 100 times in her whole life, and what she saw then was just that ogre face of her childhood seen once and then repeated at intervals and on occasions which she could neither count nor recall, like the mask in Greek tragedy, interchangeable not only from scene to scene but from actor to actor, and behind which the events and occasions took place without chronology or sequence, and leaving her actually incapable of saying how many separate times she had seen him, for the reason that, waking or sleeping, the aunt had taught her to see nothing else. On those guarded and lugubrious and even formal occasions, when she and the aunt went out to Sutpans Hundred to spend the day, and the aunt would order her to go and play with her nephew and niece exactly as the aunt might have ordered her to play a piece for company on the piano, she would not see him even at the dinner table, because the aunt would have arranged the visit to coincide with his absence. And probably Miss Rosa would have tried to avoid meeting him even if he had been there. And on the 4 or 5 occasions during the year when Ellen would bring the children in to spend the day at her father's, the aunt, that strong, vindictive, consistent woman who seems to have been twice the man that Mr. Coldfield was, and who in very truth was not only Miss Rosa's mother but her father too, cast over these visits also that same atmosphere of grim, embattled conspiracy and alliance against the two adversaries, one of whom, Mr. Coldfield, whether he could have held his own or not, had long since drawn in his pickets and dismantled his artillery and retired into the impregnable citadel of his passive rectitude, and the other, Sutphen, who probably could have engaged and even routed them, but who did not even know that he was an embattled foe, because he would not even come to the house to the noon meal. His reason may have been because of some delicacy for his father-in-law, the true reason for and beginning of the relationship between whom and himself neither the aunt nor Ellen nor Miss Rosa ever knew, which Sutphen was to divulge to but one man, and that under the pledge of confidence as long as Mr. Coldfield lived, out of regard for Mr. Coldfield's carefully nurtured name for immaculate morality, and which your grandfather said Mr. Coldfield himself never divulged for the same reason. Or perhaps the reason was the one which Miss Rosa told you, and which the aunt gave her. That now, since he had got out of his father-in-law all which Mr. Coldfield possessed that Sutphen could have used or wanted, he, Sutphen, had neither the courage to face his father-in-law nor the grace and decency to complete the ceremonial family group even 4 times a year. Or perhaps it was the reason which Sutphen gave himself, and which the aunt refused to believe because of that very fact, that he did not get to town every day, and when he did he preferred to spend it, he used the bar now, with the men who gathered each noon at the Holston House. That was the face which, when she saw it at all, was across his own dining table, the face of a foe who did not even know that it was embattled. She was 10 now, and following the aunt's dereliction, Miss Rosa now kept her father's house as the aunt had done until the night the aunt climbed out the window and vanished. There was not only no one to make her try to play with her nephew and niece on those days formal and funereal, she did not even have to go out there and breathe the same air which he breathed, and where, even though absent, he still remained, lurked in what she called sardonic and watchful triumph. She went out to Sutphen's Hundred just once a year now, when, in their Sunday clothes, she and her father drove the 12 miles in a stout battered buggy behind the stout scrubby team to spend the day. It was now Mr. Coldfield who insisted on the visits, who had never gone out with them while the aunt was there, perhaps from a sense of duty, which was the reason he gave, and which in this case even the aunt would have believed, perhaps because it was not the true one, since doubtless even Miss Rosa would not have believed the true one, which was that Mr. Coldfield wanted to see his grandchildren, regarding whom he was in a steadily increasing unease of that day when their father would tell the son at least of that old business between father and grandfather, which Mr. Coldfield was not sure yet that his son-in-law had never told. Though the aunt was gone, she still managed to bequeath and invoke upon each of these expeditions something of the old flavor of grim sortie, more than ever now against a foe who did not know that he was at war. Because now that the aunt was gone, Ellen had reneged from that triumvirate of which Miss Rosa tried without realizing it to make two. Now she was completely alone and facing across the dinner table and without support now even from Ellen. At this time Ellen went through a complete metamorphosis, emerging into her next lustrum with the complete finality of actual rebirth. Facing across the table the foe who was not even aware that he sat there, not as host and brother-in-law, but as the second party to an armistice. He probably did not even look at her twice as compared with, weighed against, his own family and children. The small, slight child whose feet, even when she would be grown, would never quite reach the floor, even from her own chairs, the ones which she would inherit, nor the ones, the objects, which she would accumulate as complement to and expression of individual character, as people do, as against Ellen, who, though small-boned also, was what is known as full-bodied, and who would have been if her life had not declined into a time when even men found little enough to eat and the end of her days had been without trouble, full-bodied indeed. Not fat, just rounded and complete, the hair white, the eyes still, even young, even a faint bloom yet on what would be dewlaps and not cheeks any longer, the small, plump, ringed, unscarified hands folded in tranquil anticipation of the food, on the damask before the Haviland beneath the candelabra which he had fetched to town years and years ago in wagons, to the astonished and affronted outrage of his fellow citizens. And against Judith, already taller than Ellen, and Henry, though not as tall for 16 as Judith was for 14, yet given promise of some day standing eye to eye with his father. This creature, this face which hardly ever spoke during the meal, with eyes like, as you put it, pieces of coal pressed into soft dough, and prim hair of that peculiar mouse-like shade of hair on which the sun does not often shine, against Judith's and Henry's out-of-doors faces. Judith with her mother's hair and her father's eyes, and Henry with his hair halfway between his father's red and Ellen's black, and eyes of a bright dark hazel. This small body, with its air of curious and paradoxical awkwardness, like a costume borrowed at the last moment, and of necessity for a masquerade which she did not want to attend. That aura of a creature cloistered now by deliberate choice and still in the throes of enforced apprenticeship to, rather than voluntary or even acquiescent participation in, breathing. This bound maid-servant to flesh and blood, waiting even now to escape it by writing a schoolgirl's poetry about the also-dead. The face, the smallest face in company, watching him across the table with still and curious and profound intensity, as though she actually had some intimation gained from that rapport with the fluid cradle of events, time, which she had acquired or cultivated by listening beyond closed doors, not to what she heard there, but by becoming supine and receptive, incapable of either discrimination or opinion or incredulity, to the pre-fever's temperature of disaster which makes soothsayers and sometimes makes them right, of the future catastrophe in which the ogre face of her childhood would apparently vanish so completely that she would agree to marry the late owner of it. That may have been the last time she saw him, because they quit going out there. Mr. Coldfield quit. There had never been any day set for the visit. One morning he would merely appear at breakfast in the decent and heavy black coat in which he had been married and had worn 52 times each year since, until Ellen married and then 53 times a year, after the aunt deserted them, until he put it on for good the day he climbed to the attic and nailed the door behind him and threw the hammer out the window and so died in it. Then Miss Rosa would retire and reappear in the formidable black or brown silk which the aunt had chosen for her years ago, and which she continued to wear on Sundays and occasions even after it was worn out, until the day when her father decided that the aunt would not return, and permitted Miss Rosa to use the clothing which the aunt had left in the house the night of her elopement. Then they would get into the buggy and depart. Mr. Coldfield first docking the two negroes for the noon meal which they would not have to prepare, and so, the town believed, charging them for the crude one of leftovers which they would have to eat. Then, one year they did not go. Doubtless Mr. Coldfield failed to come to breakfast in the black coat, and more days passed, and still he did not, and that was all. Perhaps he felt, now that the grandchildren were grown, that the draft on his conscience had been discharged, what with Henry away at the State University at Oxford, and Judith gone even further than that, into that transition stage between childhood and womanhood, where she was even more inaccessible to the grandfather, of whom she had seen but little during her life, and probably cared less anyway. That state where, though still visible, young girls appear as though seen through glass, and where even the voice cannot reach them. Where they exist, this the hoyden who could and did outrun and outclimb and ride and fight both with and beside her brother, in a pearly lambence, without shadows, and themselves partaken of it, in nebulous suspension held, strange and unpredictable, even their very shapes fluid and delicate and without substance, not in themselves floatin' and seekin', but merely waitin', parasitic and potent and serene, drawing to themselves without effort the postgenitive upon and about which to shape, flow, into back, breast, bosom, flank, thigh. Now the period began which ended in the catastrophe which caused a reversal so complete in Miss Rosa as to permit her to agree to marry the man whom she had grown up to look upon as an ogre. It was not a volt-face of character. That did not change. Even her behavior did not change to any extent. Even if Charles Bond had not died, she would in all probability have gone out to Sutphen's Hundred to live after her father's death sooner or later. And once she had done so, she would have probably passed the remainder of her life there, as she doubtless expected to do when she did go out. But if Bond had lived and he and Judith married, and Henry had remained in the known world, she would have moved, if she had moved, out there only when she was ready to, and she would have lived, if she had lived, in her dead sister's family only as the aunt, which she actually was. It was not her character. Despite the probably 6 years since she had actually seen him, and certainly the 4 years which she had spent feeding her father secretly at night while he hid from Confederate provost marshals in the attic, and at the same time writing heroic poetry about the very men from whom her father was hiding and who would have shot him or hung him without trial if they had found him, and incidentally of whom the ogre of her childhood made one, and he brought home with him a citation for valor in Lee's own hand, a good one. The face which she carried out there to live for the rest of her life was the same face which had watched him across the dinner table, and which he likewise could not have said how many times he had seen it, nor when and where, not for the reason that he was unable to forget it, but because he could probably not have remembered it enough to describe it 10 minutes after looking away, and from behind which the same woman who had been that child now watched him with that same grim and cold intensity. Although she was not to see Sutton again for years, she now saw her sister and niece more often than ever. Ellen was now at the full peak of what the aunt would have called her renegadery. She seemed not only to acquiesce, to be reconciled to her life and marriage, but to be actually proud of it. She had bloomed, as if fate were crowding the normal Indian summer, which should have bloomed gradually and faded gracefully through 6 or 8 years, into 3 or 4, either for compensation for what was to come, or to clear the books, pay the check to which his wife, Nature, had signed his name. She was in her late 30s, plump, her face unblemished still. It was as though whatever marks being in the world had left upon it up to the time the aunt vanished had been removed, eradicated at least, from between the skeleton and the skin, between the sum of experience and the envelope in which it resides, by the intervening years of a kneeling and untroubled flesh. Her carriage, air, was now a little regal. She and Judith made frequent trips to town now, calling upon the same ladies, some of whom were now grandmothers, whom the aunt had tried to force to attend the wedding 20 years ago, and, to the meager possibilities which the town offered, shopping, as though she had succeeded at last in evacuating not only the Puritan heritage but reality itself, had immolated outrageous husband and incomprehensible children into shades, escaped at last into a world of pure illusion in which, safe from any harm, she moved, lived, from attitude to attitude against her background of chatelaine to the largest, wife to the wealthiest, mother of the most fortunate. When she shopped, there were 20 stores in Jefferson now, she unbent without even getting out of the carriage, gracious and assured and talking the most complete nonsense, voluble, speaking her bright set meaningless phrases out of the part which she had written for herself, of the Duchess peripatetic with property soups and medicines among a soilless and uncompelled peasantry, a woman who, if she had had the fortitude to bear sorrow and trouble, might have risen to actual stardom in the role of the matriarch, arbitrating from the fireside corner of a crone the pride and destiny of her family, instead of turning at the last to the youngest member of it and asking her to protect the others. Often twice and sometimes 3 times a week the two of them came to town and into the house, the foolish, unreal, voluble, preserved woman now 6 years absent from the world, the woman who had quitted home and kin on a flood of tears, and in a shadowy, miasmic region something like the bitter purlieus of Styx had produced 2 children, and then rose like the swamp-hatched butterfly, unimpeded by weight of stomach and all the heavy organs of suffering and experience, into a perennial bright vacuum of arrested sun. And the young girl, dreamin', not livin', in her complete detachment and imperviousness to actuality, almost like physical deafness. To them, Miss Rosa must not have been anything at all now, not the child who had been the object and victim of the vanished aunt's vindictive unflagging care and attention, and not even the woman which her office as housekeeper would indicate, and certainly not the factual aunt herself. And it would be hard to say which of the two, sister or niece, was the most unreal to Miss Rosa in turn, the adult who had escaped reality into a bland region peopled by dolls, or the young girl who slept wakened in some suspension so completely physical as to resemble the state before birth and as far removed from reality's other extreme as Ellen was from hers, driving up to the house 2 and 3 times a week, and 1 time in the summer when Judith was 17, stopping in on their way overland to Memphis to buy Judith clothes. Yes, trousseau. That was the summer following Henry's 1st year at the university, after he had brought Charles Bond home with him for Christmas, and then again to spend a week or so of the summer vacation before Bond rode on to the river to take the steamboat home to New Orleans. The summer in which Sutphen himself went away on business, Ellen said, told, doubtless unaware, such was her existence then, that she did not know where her husband had gone, and not even conscious that she was not curious. and no one but your grandfather and perhaps Clatty ever to know that Sutphen had gone to New Orleans, too. They would enter that dim, grim, tight little house where even yet, after 4 years, the aunt still seemed to be just beyond any door, with her hand already on the knob, and which Ellen would fill with 10 or 15 minutes of shrill uproar and then depart, taking with her the dreamy and volitionless daughter who had not spoken one word. And Miss Rosa, who in actual fact was the girl's aunt, and who by actual years should have been her sister, and who in actual experience and hope and opportunity should have been the niece, ignoring the mother to follow the departing and inaccessible daughter with myopic and inarticulate yearning, and not one whit of jealousy, projecting upon Judith all the abortive dreams and delusions of her own doomed and frustrated youth, offering Judith the only gift, it of necessity offered to the bride's equipment and not the bride, it was Ellen who told this, with shrieks of amusement more than once, in her power. She offered to teach Judith how to keep house and plan meals and count laundry, receiving for the offer the blank, fathomless stare, the unhearing, what did you say? While even now Ellen was shrieking with astonished appreciation. Then they were gone. Carriage, bundles, Ellen's peacock amusement, the niece's impenetrable dreamin'. When they came to town next and the carriage stopped before Mr. Coldfield's house, one of the negresses came out and said that Miss Rosa was not at home. That summer she saw Henry again, too. She had not seen him since the summer before, although he had been home Christmas with his friend from the university. And she had heard about the balls and parties at Sutphen's Hundred during the holidays, but she and her father had not gone out. And when Henry stopped with Bon on the way back to school the day after New Year's to speak to his aunt, she actually was not at home. So she did not see him until the following summer, after a full year. She was downtown, shopping. She was standing on the street talking to your grandmother when he rode past. He didn't see her. He passed on a new mare which his father had given him, in the coat and hat of a man now. Your grandmother said he was as tall as his father now, and that he sat the mare with the same swagger, although lighter in the bone than Sutphen, as if his bones were capable of bearing the swagger, but were still too light and quick to support the pomposity. Because Sutphen was acting his role, too. He had corrupted Ellen in more ways than one. He was the biggest single landowner and cotton planter in the county now, which state he had attained by the same tactics with which he had built his house. The same single-minded unflagging effort and utter disregard of how his actions which the town could see might look, and how the indicated ones which the town could not see must appear to it. That is, there were some among his fellow citizens who believed even yet that there was a nigger in the woodpile somewhere, ranging from the ones who believed that the plantation was just a blind to his actual dark avocation, through the ones who believed that he had found some way to juggle the cotton market itself, and so get more per bale for his cotton than honest men could, to the ones who believed, apparently, that the wild niggers which he had brought there had the power to actually conjure more cotton per acre from the soil than any tame ones had ever done. He was not liked, which he evidently did not want anyway, but feared, which seemed to amuse, if not actually please, him. But he was accepted. He obviously had too much money now to be rejected or even seriously annoyed any more. He accomplished this, got his plantation to running smoothly. He had an overseer now. It was the son of that same sheriff who had arrested him at his bride-to-be's gate on the day of the betrothal. Within 10 years of the wedding, and now he acted his role too. A role of arrogant ease and leisure, which, as the leisure and ease put flesh on him, became a little pompous. Yes, he had corrupted Ellen to more than renegadery, though, like her, unaware that his flowering was a forced blooming too, and that while he was still playing the scene to the audience, behind him fate, destiny, retribution, irony, the stage manager, call him what you will, was already striking the set and dragging on the synthetic and spurious shadows and shapes of the next one. "There goes," your grandmother said. But Miss Rosa had already seen him, standing there beside your grandmother, her head hardly reaching your grandmother's shoulder, thin, in one of the dresses which the aunt had left in the house and which Miss Rosa had cut down to fit herself, who had never been taught to sew either, just as she had assumed the housekeeping and offered to teach Judith to do the same, who had never been taught to cook nor taught to do anything save listen through closed doors, standing there with a shawl over her head like she might have been 50 instead of 15, looking after her nephew and saying, "Why, he's shaved." Then she stopped seeing Ellen even. That is, Ellen also stopped coming to the house, stopped breaking the carriage's weekly ritual of store to store, where, without getting out, Ellen bade merchant and clerk fetch out to her the cloth and the meager fripperies and baubles which they carried, and which they knew even better than she that she would not buy, but instead would merely finger and handle and disarrange and then reject, all in that flow of bright, pettish volubility. Not contemptuous, not even patronizing exactly, but with a bland and even childlike imposition upon the sufferance or good manners or sheer helplessness of the men, the merchants and clerks. Then to come to the house and fill it too with that meaningless uproar of vanity, of impossible and foundationless advice about Miss Rosa and her father and the house, about Miss Rosa's clothes and the arrangement of the furniture and the food and how prepared and even the hours at which eaten. Because the time now approached, it was 1860, even Mr. Coldfield probably admitted that war was unavoidable, when the destiny of Sutphen's family, which for 20 years now had been like a lake welling from quiet springs into a quiet valley, and spreading, rising almost imperceptibly, and in which the four members of it floated in sunny suspension, felt the first subterranean movement toward the outlet, the gorge which would be the land's catastrophe too, and the four peaceful swimmers turning suddenly to face one another, not yet with alarm or distrust, but just alert, feeling the dock set, none of them yet at that point where man looks about at his companions in disaster and thinks, "When will I stop trying to save them and save only myself?" and not even aware that that point was approaching. So Miss Rosa did not see any of them, who had never seen, and was never to see alive, Charles Bond at all. Charles Bond of New Orleans, Henry's friend, who was not only some few years older than Henry, but actually a little old to be still in college, and certainly a little out of place in that one where he was, a small new college in the Mississippi hinterland and even wilderness, 300 miles from that worldly and even foreign city which was his home. A young man of a worldly elegance and assurance beyond his years, handsome, apparently wealthy, and with for background the shadowy figure of a legal guardian rather than any parents, a personage who in the remote Mississippi of that time must have appeared almost phoenix-like, full-sprung from no childhood, born of no woman and impervious to time, and vanished, leaving no bones nor dust anywhere. A man with an ease of manner and a swaggering gallant air, in comparison with which Sutphen's pompous arrogance was clumsy bluff, and Henry actually a hobbledehoy. Miss Rosa never saw him. This was a picture, an image. It was not what Ellen told her. Ellen, at the absolute halcyon of her butterfly's summer, and now with the added charm of gracious and graceful voluntary surrendering of youth to her blood's and sex's successor. That concurrent attitude and behavior, with the engagement's span, with which mothers who want to can almost make themselves the brides of their daughters' weddings. Listening to Ellen, a stranger would have almost believed that the marriage, which subsequent events would indicate had not even been mentioned between the young people and the parents, had been actually performed. Ellen did not once mention love between Judith and Bond. She did not hint around at it. Love, with reference to them, was just a finished and perfectly dead subject, like the matter of virginity would be after the birth of the first grandchild. She spoke of Bond as if he were three inanimate objects in one, or perhaps one inanimate object for which she and her family would find three concordant uses. A garment which Judith might wear as she would a riding habit or a ball gown. A piece of furniture which would complement and complete the furnishing of her house and position, and a mentor and example to correct Henry's provincial manners and speech and clothing. She seemed to have encompassed time. She postulated the elapsed years during which no honeymoon nor any change had taken place, out of which the now five faces looked with a sort of lifeless and perennial bloom like painted portraits hung in a vacuum, each taken at its forewarned peak and smoothed of all thought and experience, the originals of which had lived and died so long ago that their joys and griefs must now be forgotten even by the very boards on which they had strutted and postured and laughed and wept. This, while Miss Rosa, not listening, who had got the picture from the first word, perhaps from the name Charles Bond, the spinster doomed for life at 16, sitting beneath this bright glitter of delusion like it was one of those colored electric beams in cabarets, and she there for the first time in her life, and the beam filled with a substanceless glitter of tinsel motes darting suddenly upon her, halting for a moment, then going on. She wasn't jealous of Judith. It was not self-pity either, sitting there in one of those botched-over house dresses, the clothes cast off sometimes but usually new, which Ellen gave her from time to time, were always silk, of course, which the aunt had abandoned when she eloped with the horse-and-mule trader, perhaps in the hope or even the firm intention of never wearing such again, blinking steadily at her sister while Ellen talked. It was probably just peaceful despair and relief at final and complete abnegation, now that Judith was about to immolate the frustration's vicarious recompense into the living fairy tale. It sounded like a fairy tale when Ellen told it later to your grandmother, only it was a fairy tale written for and acted by a fashionable ladies' club. But to Miss Rosa it must have been authentic, not only plausible but justified. Hence the remark which sent Ellen again, she told this too for the childish joke it was, into shrieks of amused and fretted astonishment. "We deserve him," Miss Rosa said. "Deserve him?" Ellen said, probably shrieked too. "Of course we deserve him, if you want to put it that way. I certainly hope and expect you to feel that the Coldfields are qualified to reciprocate whatever particularly signal honor marriage with anyone might confer upon them." Naturally, there is no known rejoinder to this. At least, as far as Ellen ever told, Miss Rosa did not try to make one. She just saw Ellen depart and then set about to make Judith the second only gift in her power. She possessed two now, this one likewise bequeathed to her by the aunt who taught her both to keep house and how to fit clothes by climbing out a window one night. Though this second gift developed late, you might say repercussed, due to the fact that when the aunt left, Miss Rosa was not yet large enough to be able to use the discarded clothing even by cutting the garments down. She set about secretly making garments for Judith's trousseau. She got the cloth from her father's store. She could not have got it anywhere else. Your grandmother told me that at that time Miss Rosa actually could not count money, change, that she knew the progression of the coins in theory, but that apparently she had never had the actual cash to see, touch, experiment, and prove with. That on certain days of the week she would go downtown with a basket and shop at certain stores which Mr. Coldfield had already designated, with no coin nor sum of money changing lip or hand, and that later in the day Mr. Coldfield would trace her course by the debits scratched on paper or on walls and counters and pay them. So she would have to get the material from him. And as he had brought his entire business to Jefferson in one wagon, and this at a time when he had mother, sister, wife, and children to support out of it, as against now when he had but one child to support out of it, and weighed along with this that profound disinterest in material accumulation which had permitted conscience to cause him to withdraw from that old affair in which his son-in-law had involved him, not only at the cost of his just profits but at the sacrifice of his original investment. His stock, which had begun as a collection of the crudest necessities and which apparently could not even feed himself and his daughter from its own shelves, had not increased, let alone diversified. Yet this was where she had to go to get the material to make those intimate young girl garments which were to be for her own vicarious bridal. And you can imagine, too, what Miss Rosa's notion of such garments would be, let alone what her notion of them would look like when she had finished them unassisted. Nobody knows how she managed to get the material from her father's store. He didn't give it to her. He would have felt it incumbent on him to supply his granddaughter with clothes if she were indecently clad, or if she were ragged or cold, but not to marry in. So I believe she stole it. She must have. She must have taken it almost from under her father's nose. It was a small store, and he was his own clerk, and from any point in it he could see any other point. With that amoral boldness, that affinity for brigandage of women. But more likely, also, I would like to think, by some subterfuge of such bald and desperate transparence concocted by innocence that its very simplicity fooled him. So she didn't even see Ellen any more. Apparently Ellen had now served her purpose, completed the bright, pointless noon and afternoon of the butterfly's summer, and vanished. Perhaps not out of Jefferson, but out of her sister's life, anyway. To be seen but the one time more, dying in bed in a darkened room in the house on which fateful mischance had already laid its hand, to the extent of scattering the black foundation on which it had been erected, and removing its two male mainstays, husband and son. The one into the risk and danger of battle, the other apparently into oblivion. Henry had just vanished. She heard of that, too, while she was spending her days and nights she would have to wait until her father was asleep, sewing tediously and without skill on the garments which she was making for her niece's trousseau, and which she had to keep hidden not only from her father but from the two negresses, who might have told Mr. Coldfield. Whipping lace out of raveled and hoarded string and thread and sewing it onto garments while news came of Lincoln's election and the fall of Sumter, and she scarce listening, hearing and losing the knell and doom of her native land between two tedious and clumsy stitches on a garment which she would never wear and never remove for a man whom she was not even to see alive. Henry just vanished. She heard just what the town heard. That on this next Christmas Henry and Bond came home again to spend the holidays, the handsome and wealthy New Orleansian whose engagement to the daughter the mother had been filling the town's ears with for 6 months now. They came again, and now the town listened for the announcement of the actual day. And then something happened. Nobody knew what, whether something between Henry and Bond on one hand and Judith on the other, or between the three young people on one hand and the parents on the other. But anyway, when Christmas Day came, Henry and Bond were gone, and Ellen was not visible. She seemed to have retired to the darkened room, which she was not to quit until she died 2 years later. And nobody could have told from either Sutphen's or Judith's faces or actions or behavior. And so the tale came through the negroes, of how on the night before Christmas there had been a quarrel between not Bond and Henry or Bond and Sutphen, but between the son and the father, and that Henry had formally abjured his father and renounced his birthright and the roof under which he had been born, and that he and Bond had ridden away in the night, and that the mother was prostrate, though the town believed not at the upset of the marriage, but at the shock of reality entering her life. This the merciful blow of the axe before the beast's throat is cut, though Ellen, of course, did not know this either. That's what Miss Rosa heard. Nobody knows what she thought. The town believed that Henry's action was just the fiery nature of youth, let alone a Sutphen, and that time would cure it. Doubtless Sutphen's and Judith's behavior toward one another and toward the town had something to do with this. They would be seen together in the carriage in town now and then as though nothing had occurred between them at least, which certainly would not have been the case if the quarrel had been between Bond and the father. And probably not the case if the trouble had been between Henry and his father, because the town knew that between Henry and Judith there had been a relationship closer than the traditional loyalty of brother and sister even. A curious relationship. Something of that fierce, impersonal rivalry between two cadets in a crack regiment who eat from the same dish and sleep under the same blanket and chance the same destruction, and who would risk death for one another, not for the other's sake, but for the sake of the unbroken front of the regiment itself. That's all Miss Rosa knew. She could have known no more about it than the town knew, because the ones who did know, Sutphen or Judith, not Ellen, who would have been told nothing in the first place and would have forgot, failed to assimilate it if she had been. Ellen the butterfly, from beneath whom without warning the very sun-buoyed air had been withdrawn, leaving her now with the plump hands folded on the coverlet in the darkened room, and the eyes above them probably not even suffering but merely filled with baffled incomprehension, would not have told her any more than they would have told anyone in Jefferson or anywhere else. She probably went out there, probably once and then no more, and doubtless she did not ask, not even Judith, perhaps knowing she would not be told, or perhaps because she was waiting. And she must have told Mr. Coldfield that there was nothing wrong, and evidently she believed that herself, since she continued to sew on the garments for Judith's wedding. She was still doing that when Mississippi seceded, and when the first Confederate uniforms began to appear in Jefferson, where Colonel Sartorius and Sutphen were raising the regiment which departed in 61, with Sutphen, second in command, riding at Colonel Sartorius's left hand, on the black stallion named out of Scott, beneath the regimental colors which he and Sartorius had designed, and which Sartorius's women folks had sewed together out of silk dresses. He had filled out physically from what he had been not only when he first rode into Jefferson that Sunday in 33, but from what he had been when he and Ellen married. He was not portly yet, though he was now getting on toward 55. The fat, the stomach, came later. It came upon him suddenly, all at once, in the year after whatever it was happened to his engagement to Miss Rosa, and she quitted his roof and returned to town to live alone in her father's house and did not ever speak to him again except when she addressed him that one time when they told her that he was dead. The flesh came upon him suddenly, as though what the Negroes and Wash Jones, too, called the fine figure of a man, had reached and held its peak after the foundation had given away, and something between the shape of him that people knew and the uncompromising skeleton of what he actually was had gone fluid, and, earthbound, had been snubbed up and restrained, balloon-like, unstable and lifeless, by the envelope which it had betrayed. She did not see the regiment depart, because her father forbade her to leave the house until it was gone, refusing to allow her to take part in or be present with the other women and girls in the ceremony of its departure, though not because his son-in-law happened to be in it.
This book is continued on Disc 3.
She did not see the regiment depart because her father forbade her to leave the house until it was gone, refusing to allow her to take part in or be present with the other women and girls in the ceremony of its departure, though not because his son-in-law happened to be in it. He had never been an irascible man, and before war was actually declared and Mississippi seceded, his acts and speeches of protest had been not only calm but logical and quite sensible. But after the die was cast, he seemed to change overnight, just as his daughter Ellen changed her nature a few years before. As soon as troops began to appear in Jefferson, he closed his store and kept it closed all during the period that soldiers were being mobilized and drilled, not only then but later, after the regiment was gone, whenever casual troops would bivouac for the night in passing, refusing to sell any goods for any price, not only to the military but, so it was told, to the families not only of soldiers but of men or women who had supported secession and war only in talk, opinion. Not only did he refuse to permit his sister to come back home to live while her horse trader husband was in the army, he would not even allow Miss Rosa to look out the window at passing soldiers. He had closed his store permanently and was at home all day now. He and Miss Rosa lived in the back of the house, with the front door locked and the front shutters closed and fastened, where, so the neighbors said, he spent the day behind one of the slightly opened blinds like a picket on post, armed not with a musket but with the big family Bible, in which his and his sister's birth and his marriage, and Ellen's birth and marriage, and the birth of his two grandchildren and of Miss Rosa, and his wife's death, but not the marriage of the aunt, it was Miss Rosa who entered that, along with Ellen's death on the day when she entered Mr. Coldfield's own and Charles Bond's and even Sutphen's, had been duly entered in his neat clerk's hand, until a detachment of troops would pass, whereupon he would open the Bible and declaim in a harsh, loud voice, even above the sound of the tramping feet, the passages of the old violent vindictive mysticism which he had already marked as the actual picket would have ranged his row of cartridges along the windowsill. Then one morning he learned that his store had been broken into and looted, doubtless by a company of strange troops bivouacked on the edge of town and doubtless abetted, if only vocally, by his own fellow citizens. That night he mounted to the attic with his hammer and his handful of nails and nailed the door behind him and threw the hammer out the window. He was not a coward. He was a man of uncompromising moral strength. Coming into a new country with a small stock of goods and supporting 5 people out of it in comfort and security, at least. He did it by close trading, to be sure. He could not have done it save by close trading or dishonesty. And as your grandfather said, the man who, in a country such as Mississippi was then, would restrict dishonesty to the selling of straw hats and hamstrings and salt meat would have been already locked up by his own family as a kleptomaniac. But he was not a coward, even though his conscience may have objected, as your grandfather said, not so much to the idea of pouring out human blood and life, but at the idea of waste, of wearing out and eating up and shooting away material in any cause whatever. Now Miss Rosa's life consisted of keeping it in herself and her father. Up to the night of the looting of the store, they had lived out of it. She would go to the store after dark with a basket and fetch back enough food to last for a day or two. So the stock, not renewed for some time before that, was considerably reduced even before the looting. And soon she, who had never been taught to do anything practical because the aunt had raised her to believe that she was not only delicate but actually precious, was cooking the food, which as time passed became harder and harder to come by and poorer in quality, and hauling it up to her father at night by means of a well pulley and rope attached to the attic window. She did this for 3 years, feeding in secret and at night and with food which in quantity was scarcely sufficient for one, the man whom she hated. And she may not have known before that she hated him, and she may not have known it now, even. Nevertheless, the first of the odes to Southern soldiers in that portfolio, which, when your grandfather saw it in 1885, contained 1,000 or more, was dated in the first year of her father's voluntary incarceration, and dated at 2 o'clock in the morning. Then he died. One morning the hand did not come out to draw up the basket. The old nails were still in the door, and neighbors helped her break it in with axes, and they found him, who had seen his sole means of support looted by the defenders of his cause, even if he had repudiated it and them, with 3 days uneaten food beside his pallet bed, as if he had spent the 3 days in a mental balancing of his terrestrial accounts, found the result and proved it, and then turned upon his contemporary scene of folly and outrage and injustice the dead and consistent impassivity of a cold and inflexible disapproval. Now Miss Rosa was not only an orphan, but a pauper, too. The store was now just a shell, the deserted building vacated even by rats and containing nothing, not even goodwill, since he had irrevocably estranged himself from neighbors, town, and embattled land all three by his behavior. Even the 2 negresses, which he had freed as soon as he came into possession of them, through a debt, by the way, not purchase, writing out their papers of freedom which they could not read and putting them on a weekly wage which he held back in full against the discharge of the current market value at which he had assumed them on the debt, and in return for which they had been among the first Jefferson Negroes to desert and follow the Yankee troops, were gone now. So when he died he had nothing, not only saved but kept. Doubtless the only pleasure which he had ever had was not in the meager Spartan hoard which he had accumulated before his path crossed that of his future son-in-law. Not in the money, but in its representation of a balance in whatever spiritual counting-house he believed would some day pay his sight-drafts on self-denial and fortitude. And doubtless what hurt him most in the whole business with Sutphen was not the loss of the money, but the fact that he had had to sacrifice the hoarding, the symbol of the fortitude and abnegation, to keep intact the spiritual solvency which he believed that he had already established and secured. It was as if he had had to pay the same note twice because of some trifling oversight of date or signature. So Miss Rosa was both pauper and orphan, with no kin above dust but Judith and the aunt who had been last heard of 2 years ago while trying to pass the Yankee lines to reach Illinois, and so be near the Rock Island prison where her husband, who had offered his talents for horse and mule getting to the Confederate Cavalry Remount Corps, and had been caught at it, now was. Ellen was dead 2 years now, the butterfly, the moth, caught in a gale and blown against a wall and clinging there, beaten feebly. Not with any particular stubborn clinging to life, not in particular pain, since it was too light to have struck hard, nor even with very much remembrance of the bright vacuum before the gale, but just in bewildered and uncomprehending amazement. The bright trivial shell not even to any great extent changed, despite the year of bad food, since all of Sutpen's negroes had deserted also to follow the Yankee troops away. The wild blood which he had brought into the country and tried to mix, blend, with the tame which was already there, with the same care and for the same purpose with which he blended that of the stallion and that of his own, and with the same success, as though his presence alone compelled that house to accept and retain human life, as though houses actually possess a sentience, a personality and character, acquired not from the people who breathe or have breathed in them, so much as rather inherent in the wood and brick, or begotten upon the wood and brick by the man or men who conceived and built them. In this one, an incontrovertible affirmation for emptiness, desertion, an insurmountable resistance to occupancy, save when sanctioned and protected by the ruthless and the strong. She had lost some flesh, of course, but it was as the butterfly itself enters dissolution by actually dissolving. The area of wing and body decreasing a little, the pattern of the spots drawn a little closer together, but with no wrinkle to show. The same smooth, almost girlish face on the pillow, though Miss Rosa now discovered that Ellen had been dyeing her hair evidently for years. The same almost plump, soft, though now unringed hands on the coverlet, and only the bafflement in the dark, uncomprehending eyes to indicate anything of present life by which to postulate approaching death, as she asked the 17-year-old sister. Henry up to now has just vanished, his birthright voluntarily repudiated. He had not yet returned to play his final part in his family's doom. And this, your grandfather said, spared Ellen too, not that it would have been the crushing and crowning blow, but that it would have been wasted on her, since the clinging moth, even alive, would have been incapable now of feeling any more of wind or violence, to protect the remaining child. So the natural thing would have been for her to go out and live with Judith, the natural thing for her or any southern woman, gentlewoman. She would not have needed to be asked. No one would expect her to wait to be, because that's what a southern lady is. Not the fact that penniless and with no prospect of ever being otherwise, and knowing that all who know her know this, yet moving with a parasol and a private chamber pot and three trunks into your home and into the room where your wife uses the hand-embroidered linen, and not only takes command of all the servants who likewise know that she will never tip them because they know as well as the white folks that she will never have anything to tip them with, but goes into a kitchen and dispossesses the cook and seasons the very food you are going to eat to suit her own palate. It's not this that she is dependent on to keep body and soul together. It is as though she were living on the actual blood itself like a vampire, not with insatiability, certainly not with voracity, but with that serene and idle splendor of flowers arrogating to herself, because it fills her veins also, nourishment from the old blood that crossed uncharted seas and continents and battled wilderness hardships and lurking circumstances and fatalities, with tranquil disregard of whatever onerous cocks to leisure and even peace which the preservation of it incurs upon what might be called the contemporary transmutable fountainhead, who contrives to keep the crass, food-bearing corpuscles sufficiently numerous and healthy in the stream. That's what she would have been expected to do, but she didn't. Though Judith was an orphan too, yet Judith still had those abandoned acres to draw from, let alone Clytie to help her, keep her company, and Wash Jones to feed her as Wash had fed Ellen before she died. But Miss Rosa didn't go out there at once. Perhaps she never would have gone, although Ellen had asked her to protect Judith. Possibly she felt that Judith did not need protection yet, since if even deferred love could have supplied her with the will to exist, endure for this long, then that same love, even though deferred, must and would preserve bond until the folly of men would stalemate from sheer exhaustion, and he would return from wherever he was and bring Henry with him, Henry victim too of the same folly and mischance. She must have seen Judith now and then, and Judith probably urged her to come out to Sutphen's Hundred to live. But I believe that this is the reason she did not go. Even though she did not know where Bonn and Henry were, and Judith apparently never thought to tell her. Because Judith knew. She may have known for some time. Even Ellen may have known, only probably to Ellen at that time absence was not a qualitative state, absence into ignominy or into oblivion being identical, and so it may not have occurred to Ellen either to tell her sister that to another the uncertainty of battle and the certainty of oblivion might be two things. Or perhaps Judith never told her mother either. Perhaps Ellen did not know before she died that Henry and Bonn were now privates in the company which their classmates at the university had organized. Miss Rosa did not know it at all. The first intimation she had had in 4 years that her nephew was still alive was the afternoon when Wash Jones, riding Sutphen's remaining mule, stopped in front of the house and began to shout her name. She had seen him before, but she did not recognize him. A gaunt, gangling man, malaria-ridden with pale eyes and a face that might have been any age between 25 and 60, sitting on the saddleless mule in the street before the gate, shouting, "Hello! Hello!" at intervals until she came to the door. Whereupon he lowered his voice somewhat, though not very much. "Are you Rosie Coldfield?" he said.